Welcome to the Team Flower Podcast. My name is Kelly, and we are gathering today to inspire you in your work with flowers.
Hi there, this is Jesse with Team Flower. Welcome to the podcast. I am sharing with you today a tech tip. We're doing something new for a few episodes on the podcast, sharing some technology tips that hopefully can make your business more efficient and save you time, which we all need. Today's tech tip is about a service that helps automate your business, and it's called Zapier, spelled Z-A-P-I-E-R. There's another similar service called IFTTT. It stands for If This, Then That, but you can just Google IFTTT. Anyway, both services do similar things. Zapier is better. Zapier is more advanced. It's more business focused, and there's more features to it. So let me tell you what the service does. Basically, what both of these services do is connect the different services of your business together. And you can set up rules so that your business services behave a certain way and do actions on your behalf automatically. Let me give you a specific example because that is very vague. You can connect your Gmail account, for example, to where if you label an email with a certain label, it could then add to a spreadsheet that email, the subject line. It could also add to your to-do list, assuming you use some service to keep track of to-do items, to follow up on that email. It could send an auto reply, which I know you can already do in Gmail rules, but you can connect the different services of your business together. Another thing is you could have inquiries come in through a web form, and then you can automate using Zapier to follow up with that person in 3 days. Follow up if they haven't scheduled with you yet. You can automate your accounting software. You can automate your calendar. You can automate your to-do items, to-do repeating reminders for your business. It's so open-ended that it's hard to give you concrete examples, but I think when you sign up for the service and then start plugging in the services that your business uses, you'll see some examples of how you can automate everything together. It's one of those things where just having it set up and having it in the back of your mind, if you go throughout the course of a month of business and you find yourself doing repetitive tasks through the various online services you use for your business, again, whether that's email, calendar, to-do items, video conferencing, website stuff. If you see yourself doing repetitive tasks, especially when it comes to communicating with others, whether it's people on your team, if you have people working with you, or clients, or even vendors, and you see the opportunity for automation, this service is the platform that can handle automating those tasks. It's kind of the connective tissue, if you will, of pulling all of the services that you use in your business together. And you can, it's very visual. You can set up the rules to where you can connect to the services together, and say, if this happens, then do that, or have this certain task happen every Monday at a certain time. Again, it's very open-ended. And if you're just getting started in flowers, this is not for you. Okay. So this service is really for the business owners that, have gone through at least a year of business and you kind of know the regular routines of your business a little bit. And certainly if you're further along in your business, then this will be helpful to you. So if you're a beginner and you're just discovering flowers, maybe catalog this for the future. Don't worry about signing up for it now because it'll be way too much not helpful right now. But if you have people that work with you, if you have regular routines in your business, if your business has been in existence for a year, a few years, many years beyond that, check this service out. It still might not be for you. You mentally, you may just not think through things this way, and that's fine. I'm a very programmatic thinker, so this is my cup of tea when it comes to how I structure things. So if you look at this and it's just not your cup of tea, that's fine. If it's not how you do things, no problem. You're not missing out. But for those of you, especially if you're doing high volume work, and you're getting a lot of inquiries, or you're doing a lot of transactions, and there's a lot to keep track of, I think this service will be helpful for you. Again, that's Zapier or IFTTT, but Zapier is probably the one you should use. IFTTT is more for consumer services and less business-oriented. Anyway, if this has been helpful, or if it hasn't been helpful, let me know that as well, please. Email me, jp@teamflower.org. Look forward to hearing from you. And now you're going to hear from Matt Collins, who's on the podcast today. He's going to have an interview up next, so enjoy that.
I have a feeling there's quite a lot of people who listen to this podcast. They're not florists, but they're thinking about it. Is that you? Are you dreaming of a life with flowers, but you just haven't taken that leap yet? Well, I wanted to make sure that you know about the How to Become a Florist class from Team Flower. It is designed to help people get on the path to a meaningful, passion-filled career in flowers that makes a difference in the world. You can use your passion for good, self-sustainable products and make people smile, because life is just, it's too short to have a career that you aren't passionate about. Now, I'm not offering, like, you know, a worry-free life. I'm not offering a life with no stress, or a life that, you know, just involves birds, like singing outside all the time. But I am offering you a passion-filled career, and passion is the thing that propels you through any and every obstacle that might come your way. So if a career in flowers is something that you've been thinking about, I hope you'll consider joining How to Become a Florist. We're starting class again tomorrow. You can hop in and join. You haven't missed a beat. Just go to howtobecomeaflorist.com to register, and I'll see you in class tomorrow. Again, that's howtobecomeaflorist.com. Today, our special guest is Matt Collins. He is a writer and gardener, and his main interest with flowers is seeing them grow in their wild natural habitat, either at home or abroad, and then translating that into work in the garden, letting the environment and habitat dictate how plants should be grown. This is the theme of his monthly column with the Daily Telegraph in the UK, and to some extent, the subject of his new book called Florist. He works at the Garden Museum in central London, looking after and developing the gardens. He also runs an annual traineeship program for new horticulturalists. Very excited to talk to you today, Matt.
Yeah, good to chat with you.
You've just got an affinity for seeing flowers growing in that wild natural habitat. Tell us a little bit about that translation process. What's it look like for you? What are you looking for when you're out, you know, just taking nature in? And then how does that translate into work in the garden?
I think it's like a subject that's kind of getting lots of gardeners hooked more and more these days. It used to feel like a bit of a niche in a way, of something to write about within the kind of horticultural sphere. But now it seems like lots of people are into it. But for me, it's really, I think it started with just seeing plants on, you know, on holiday, I guess, and recognizing, you know, I mean, as Brits, we went around, I mean, to a great extent, you know, in quite sort of a bad taste in a kind of appalling way. We went around ransacking countries, you know, for centuries and bringing back plants to the UK. So we have this, you know, we have a monumental debt to countries all over the world in terms of our flora, because the British temperate climate, you know, doesn't have a huge amount of, I mean, we have some amazing wildflowers, but but we our gardens are really just a complete sort of mishmash of plants from all around the world. So it was really going on holiday and recognizing plants that I'd been growing in the gardens in their natural environments. And then I suppose the translation thing is, you see, when you see plants growing wild, you obviously see what they like and where they want to put themselves, and you know, the kind of plants they like to grow beside or in company with, or in the kind of environments that they, you know, they really thrive in. So if it's something that's, you know, if it's a dry climate, or if it's an alpine climate, or very damp or shaded, all that kind of thing. So yeah, I think it's really just sort of seeing where plants love to be, and then kind of saying, hey, well, this is the best way to apply that to your garden, however big or small.
So you're kind of looking for places that mimic those types of ecosystems. You're noticing that the spot is really damp, and that reminds you of, you know, a place that you went or you visited where you saw this kind of collection of plants.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely works that way more for me, that way around, I suppose. Yeah, exactly. You see sort of the kind of empty spaces within your garden, or the certain environments that are created, whether it's, you know, just a tiny bit of shade from a shed or something to a really sun-baked area. And yeah, it does take you back to places you've been and make you think about what plants are really happy there.
And tell us a little bit more about the work that you do at the Garden Museum. If we were to visit, what would we see at the Garden Museum? What's happening there? And tell us about where you drew on your inspiration for that.
Well, I mean, I've been there a long time. I've been there about 10 years. It's right bang in the middle of London. It faces Westminster. So you see Big Ben literally through the garden. And so it couldn't be in a more kind of amazing, inspiring location. But it's been going since the 70s. It lives inside this old decommissioned church, this very historic church on the south side of the Thames. And so it's got this really cool kind of I suppose an element of spirituality about it anyway, because of the nature of the building that houses the Garden Museum. But it's really gone from strength to strength over the last especially the last decade, since a kind of a remodeling and a revamp of the interior architecture, and then some sort of extensive buildings outside. So it really, the whole purpose is to celebrate the culture and art of gardens, really, and all the people that are involved in that, particularly the British culture of gardening, but also international as well. And it could be all sorts of things. So we have exhibitions, permanent collections, from anything from old tools to really exciting new contemporary art from international artists. So it's a lot. I mean, the guy, people kind of come expecting there to be extensive gardens, but there aren't. It's a small space. And so what we do, we have a very sort of special interior courtyard, and that kind of celebrates and discusses, I suppose, the idea of where plants come from. And it was designed by a high profile designer called Dan Pearson, who's done lots of gardens all around the world, and he's come up with this wonderful scheme that sort of looks at these interesting plants, and plants that you might not necessarily recognize, plants that aren't all that familiar in British gardening. And the idea is that people come in and are wowed by what they see in the museum and by the garden, and feel slightly almost alienated by it is the idea, which sounds a bit strange, but the idea of feeling kind of almost out of your depth. We don't label any plants there. We have it as quite kind of free, and you're meant to sort of interpret the space how you feel, but it's meant to kind of inspire designers as well as people who've never kind of encountered plants of, you know, of that kind before.
It is, I forget what stop number, but if you're in the city and you hop on one of those big red buses, which is what I did the first time that I was in the city. It is apparently, they said on the bus stop that it was the stop that no one gets off at, but it wasn't very clearly labeled like what was there. But I did just feel this like intense, like draw to like get my body off of the bus and go to whatever was over there. And then after the fact, I looked it up because I was just so curious, because I felt, but I didn't get off the bus. But I felt so curious about it. And then when I looked it up, I was like, oh, and it was under construction at the time. That's when you guys were remodeling.
Right.
But I was like, oh, that's the Garden Museum. So when I went back the second time, I made sure to get off at the stop that no one gets off or on at, and it was the It's the garden museum. But that just tells you it is one of those secret hidden treasures that, you know, when it's your moment to find it, it finds you. It's like flowers, right? I feel like that they find us whenever we need them. And that's one of the things that makes them so special and just, connects us with the natural world.
Yeah, you're totally, that's amazing. That's exactly, I mean, that's basically how I found it as well. Like, I love that you got, I didn't know that it was a lesser used stop. That's, I mean, I can imagine, because there's very little in that. It's kind of occupies a strange part of the south bank of the river, really. It's, you're sandwiched between all these amazing buildings and these big sites, but it's within this little kind of quieter stretch of the river. But I literally did the same. I walked past, I was sort of staying in London and living elsewhere, and just happened to walk past it and thought, oh, gosh, I've never even heard of that before. And it sounds amazing. And walked in, and I think I asked if they had any volunteer opportunities. And they said, no, we've got a traineeship that we're just about to start, a 1-year traineeship. Do you want to apply? I was like, yeah, straight away. So yeah, amazing. So I just got involved from the second that I saw it, really.
Wow, that's so cool. Okay, tell us about writing. What's your freelance writing career like? Where does it take you? What are some things that you've discovered? Tell us more about that.
I've discovered it's really hard. my aim with it was that I always wanted to garden at the same time as writing. It was always important to me that it's almost like a 50-50 split. So I don't know. I'd say it's been the last sort of 5 or 6 years in terms of a trajectory. I was a full-time gardener for a long time, but I always kind of admired, in terms of garden writing and garden journalism, I always admired the gardeners, and there are very few of them, but gardeners who are employed as gardeners, but also write. There are lots of gardeners who are employed full-time and do the odd piece or the odd short column, but very few end up sort of really devoting, you know, a substantial part of their working week to writing. And so that was always kind of the object for me. And it's taken a really, really long time to establish. I mean, building up a client base and, you know, sort of regular people that I write for and magazines and newspapers, that kind of thing. So yeah, the idea was really just so that one would influence the other, I suppose. It's amazing what you learn when you research articles or books, and that really takes you into the, you know, into the garden and sort of inspires what you plant from, I suppose, what you've been researching. And then obviously very similarly, what you're planting really informs what you're writing about. So yeah, that's kind of always been the goal. And I'd say it's only really started to pan out in the last sort of, yeah, I'd say the last couple of years. I wrote a book about forests, and that came out in 2019. And I think it was sort of off the back of that things started sort of moving to the point where I could sort of really sort of financially commit, I suppose, to a sort of split week between gardening and writing.
Hmm. Tell us more about that book. What's inside of it? What could we expect whenever it lands at our doorsteps?
Yeah, it's okay. So it's been out a little while. It was a really fun commission. I'd done a couple of little books for a publisher, a UK-based but international publisher, and I pitched the idea with a photographer friend about sort of reconnecting the idea of basically through trees. So reconnecting trees related to each other that sort of, you know, within the same genus, so that span the globe effectively. So an example might be a kind of birch tree, a story about a birch tree in the UK, whether it's someone using it for paper or using it for design or any kind of, basically any kind of story or use for that tree, and then relating that to birch trees. I think for that one we went off to, where did we go? We went to Czech Republic to then go and look at birch trees sort of occupying these high, crazy forest, sort of very, very high sandstone forests, basically. And so the idea is you connect these kind of stories about trees, these very personal stories about trees, with the context of their massive kind of international forest environment, I suppose.
If you feel like trees could talk, what would they say?
Leave us alone. I don't know. Yeah, what would they say? I think they're just too old, aren't they? They're probably too old to want to talk to you. They've got way too much to talk about, I suppose. Mm. Yeah, we saw some amazing. We went to I think one of my favorites was going through Oregon, like to the sort of central area of Oregon, and seeing some of those really old juniper trees that you have there. Mm. Mm-hmm. They're like 1700 years old and stuff, and yeah, it was kind of staggering. We were showing this one tree that had been out in the high desert there, and someone had taken a core sample and sort of cut right through, because they're so weird and their shapes are so strange, and they have, you know, they've learned to live in this kind of ridiculously hostile environment in the desert there, and you look at these trees and think they can't possibly be that old, but when they get dated, they are just like been there for so, and they survived like fire and drought, and yeah, it's just, yeah, I don't know, I suppose just focusing in on these, some of these species trees, it's just quite amazing what they are effectively telling you. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, definitely a testament to endurance and carrying on. Did you guys talk at all about ginkgo trees in the book?
I think it came up as one of our options, but it would have meant a really expensive trip to China, I think. We had to weigh the whole thing up against finances. But
of course.
It was an option for a while, yeah.
Yeah, I think those are so cool. There's a grove of them in our town, I think. I think there was maybe like a connection to maybe like a sister city overseas. Okay. And we have this really cool, just like little alley of them. And whenever they all burst into that bright yellow and just confetti leaves everywhere, I just really enjoy that whole process. I was reading that they're one of the most ancient, ancient trees. So anyway, I got a little one to plant here at our house to remind me to endure.
Yeah.
Carry nice. On.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. Mm, yeah. Cool. It's a good one. That golden, I think that, yeah, you've got it with the poplar trees as well. What do you call them? Cottonwoods. Mm-hmm. That amazing golden, yes, that autumnal color is just outstanding, really.
Mm. I don't know. Have you ever been to the Grand Canyon before?
I did a 1-day trip to the Grand Canyon.
Oh,
yeah.
Did you? Good.
That was my last trip in America. I took a train from Chicago down with my brother for like a pre. I had my first child in 2020 in the beginning, uh-huh. just before the pandemic, and so I took this knowing that was on the horizon. I took a sort of last quick rush trip to America for an article with my brother, and we traveled all the way down from Chicago to Arizona. And you can't go to Arizona without seeing the Grand Canyon, obviously. So mm-hmm. Yeah, that was just mind blowing. Like, it was just ridiculous. I felt a bit stupid being there for 1 day, but that was amazing. Yeah. What were you going to say about the canyon?
Well, I was just thinking about, I'm not sure if it's the exact, I think we're talking about the same tree, but there's a cottonwood campground on the north rim about halfway down into the canyon. And my dad, I think I was 16, we hiked rim to rim and then proceeded to do it like, I think I've hiked the Grand Canyon 4 or 5 times. Little known fact. I don't ever talk about that.
Nice. Good
But yeah, Cottonwood Campground has just this grove of these fantastic trees that we camped outside under. And I'll never forget just how clear the sky was and the sun and, or the stars and all of those sounds and pieces of it. But I distinctly remember just those cottonwood, those cottonwoods and being out there underneath them. It was really special. Man. Yeah.
No, I can't. Yeah. See, there you go. Even more embarrassing. I've only seen it once and I need to go back properly.
Oh, well, yeah. There's so many. Yeah. There's so many things to see there. Oh my goodness. Yes. But okay. If you like hiking and you like it really hot, it's a great thing to do.
I like one of those things.
If the heat is not that appealing to you, it is not the place to go. Oh my goodness. 120 degrees down there at the bottom. Mm.
Jesus. I mean, we can't even cope. It's like, yeah, we're going to get confused on measurements of heat, but ours is, I mean, right now we're going through what Britain considers to be a heat wave, and by North American standards, it's positively sort of tepid and you know, even, but we just can't take it. It's far too warm for us. It's just not made for this weather, but yeah, I'll do it for the cottonwoods though, for sure.
Yeah. Well, switching back over into growing a garden, maintaining a garden, do you happen to have, I don't know, what would be maybe like your top 3 tips for somebody who is in that in that vein of interest as well and wants to go for it.
Sure. Well, I think, I mean, it's a cliche. I mean, all of these are cliches, right? But the very first thing is just to observe. If you've just got like a brand new garden, I mean, the best thing, the worst thing you can do is get straight in there and start digging around, because it's great just to see what comes up. I've actually just spent the last year in a slightly overgrown, huge 3-acre garden, observing effectively. It's a place that might be sort of taken on by the garden museum, but just seeing what's there, because before you dig in and, you know, and get going with plans and stuff, it's so important to see what might already be hiding underground. I've certainly learned more about that this year, about just waiting and sort of watching. So there's that one. And then in terms of what you put in there, I mean, the other thing, I guess two other points. So environment, obviously, like I was talking about, really just plants that's going to suit, you know, only bother planting things that are going to really love it there. Like, no one wants to spend all their time watering and, you know, kind of helping plants along, feeding plants when they don't, you know, when you could just find a plant that's going to be really happy in that particular environment that you've got. I'd say that's really important. And then I would say, what was going to be my third point? Plant in groups. I mean, just repeating plants rather than just throwing loads and loads of things in there. I mean, you should grow what you love, and that's the most important thing, I suppose, but it's good to grow like a few things of what you love, you know, like for each species, chuck three or six in there, so you at least get some kind of cohesion. I get a bit stressed out if there are just like single plant, just like loads and loads and loads of different species. It's just, I don't necessarily find that super calming, whereas I think if you just repeated, you know, even if you pick 9 key plants, if you repeat those, then you'll start to feel quite sort of, I think it brings a sense of harmony and relaxation, and you want the space to feel like that.
Mm-hmm. I inherited a pretty large garden, and before, whenever I had done my first one, I was, you know, I would get something for a wedding or an event that I needed to do, and then I would just put that in the ground, you know?
Yeah, nice.
I had one of those and it went in the ground. I had another one of those and it went in the ground, or, you know, whatever, because I was looking for those really special transitional flowers for arrangements and things like that. But when I got into this new space and this new garden, she repeated things, and she was very intentional about that. And it has a completely different feeling than the one that I, you know, than the one that I did the first time. And I think that's such good advice. And I always feel tempted when I see that plant that I really, you know, love at the garden center. I think to myself, I have to buy, you know, I have to buy at least, you know, 3 or 6 of those. And, you know, when you think about like creating a flower arrangement, a lot of us on here are florists, you know, you have about 9 ingredients that you use to create a centerpiece, and you repeat the stems. You have, you know, 3, 5, you know, maybe 7 or 9 of that particular ingredient in your arrangement. And it's the same way in the garden, except it's per plant instead of per stem.
Completely. Yeah. I was going to say, you must feel there's some sort of correlation between doing these kind of lovely floral designs and applying that to your garden. Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely so much of it. All of these design things are very translatable, but you just kind of have to figure out where those bridges across are.
Totally. Do you ever just stick one of something in there?
In whenever I do an arrangement?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if I do, like right now, this morning I was making an arrangement and I just had like one beautiful tiger lily. And that's all that the garden had that day. Right. But I can repeat the color, or I can do something else to, you know, make it feel unified, even if I just have one. So I would say, yes, sometimes there is just one, and I only have one tiger lily in my garden right now too. So, you know,
I think you have no tiger lilies in your garden right now, right?
Yeah. Well, no, technically no. Yes. That is correct.
Yeah. So it does fit. It's the same thing, I think. Yeah, you're right. And that's quite a good idea, is actually, if you are going to put in a few sort of one-off plants. Yeah. I guess if you're repeating that color, that's the same kind of thing. Yeah.
You know, I have a question for you about my garden. We tore out a whole bunch of stuff in the front. And whenever you are thinking about just putting those layers back in there. I was trying to imagine it like a flower arrangement, like I have my foundation and then I sort of have my fill and then my little like light things on top. So I was going to go for, you know, layering in those things kind of like once, you know, like just each year focus on one of those.
Right.
Layers, but putting the first plant in the ground is really hard, really hard. Do you have any tips for that?
You mean in terms of choosing that one or how to?
Yeah, just like, where do you put it? Like if it's in relationship to a building, you know, is there, you know, do you just pick a place and you just put it in, you know, you just got to dig a hole and put it somewhere.
I think you do. I think I'm, you know what? I'm really bad. I'm terrible for, rearranging. Like I do it way too much, even when I know.
Okay, that helps me feel better because that is what I feel like I am doing and will continue to do for a little bit here.
I think that's fine. I was doing that today, mm-hmm. this morning, actually. Yeah. And I do it. I'm bad because I'm impatient and I'll do it when it shouldn't be, you know, right in the height of summer, mm-hmm. when it's, it can barely get its roots down, you know, to get enough water anyway. And then you've moved it and it's struggling. But I think, yeah, I think I've done that with borders and with areas of gardens, you know, loads and loads and loads. I think that's the fun of it, really, is you build up and you build up and you build up and you get your collection and then you want to rearrange it and stuff grows into stuff. And I think that's, you know, I think it's an obvious point, but a garden is no fun if it stays the same. Like the whole point is the process of doing it and trying to always better that. I'm sure it's the same with arrangements as well when you're doing floral. You're just like, you know, that just like, actually, if you took that right out and then stuck it like the whole other side of the arrangement or matched it with something else, it would feel so much better. So, yeah, I think that's the fun, really. That's the fun.
Yeah. And I think it's good to balance the gardening with the flower arranging, because flower arranging has a very quick turnaround time and gardening, boy, it takes quite a lot of patience to see if that move works for, you know, you wait 365 days to see, it all come out exactly like you thought, you know, it was going to, and you, at that point, you don't even remember that you moved it. Oh my goodness. So funny.
Totally. Yeah. Well, that too, I keep moving stuff, forgetting where I put it. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Boy, yep, it's a good way
to put it anywhere you want
to develop.
Get going, don't waste time. Come on,
I love it. Okay, let's do you want to play a fun little game?
Yeah,
I'm gonna name a feeling and then tell me the first flower that comes to mind whenever I say that. Okay,
wow, I love this game already. Okay, go.
Okay, the first one is playful.
Playful. Poppies.
Powerful.
Oh, you're saying that about, that's the next word. That's not poppies. Yeah. Powerful. Echinacea.
Ah, I like it. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
Tough one.
Mm-hmm. How about optimistic?
Oh, that's got to be a bulb, really, isn't it? Tulip.
Thankful.
Something particularly floriferous, I would say. So thankful, cornflowers or something like that. Cornflowers, I think. Mm-hmm. Do you call them cornflowers over there?
They're blue. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh yeah. The fields are alive with them right now. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Wow. All the meadows, just they're blue and the clovers out mixed in with them. It's beautiful. And the black and white cows, grazing. It's just, it's so idyllic right now. I love it.
I bet. Yeah, it's a good time. Oh, I want to get there. I want to come. Yes. I want to be over there.
Yes, yes. Okay, one more. Hopeful.
Hopeful. I don't know why. That one's a hard one. I'm not getting a vibe with that one. What about, I'm kind of hopeful about every single flower, really. I mean, it's...
Hey, that's a good answer too. They do carry a lot of hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a hard one. I don't know why, but I think, they're all kind of hopeful in their own way, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. So fun. They do. They carry so many feelings. And whenever we combine them in our garden designs and our arrangements, we can communicate without words, which is one of the biggest blessings of learning this language. We can communicate with anyone across barriers of culture and all those kinds of things. It's really
totally.
Just shoot straight for the human heart. Well, Matt, anything last question? I always just anything that might be on your heart for the floral community today that you feel like that you carry or that you are just an ambassador for, something that you want people to know. If you had a microphone and could shout it from the rooftops, it's that thing.
I think, I mean, there's some really big sort of, I mean, yeah, the world is really quite sort of, you know, environmentally falling apart, really, isn't it? And not to be like downy on it, but it's hard, you know. It's like you sort of, I suppose you talk about hope, but you kind of do sow flowers in a sort of under a veil of hope at the moment, because it does feel like the world is warming up and the environment is getting tough, and you know, and I think it's one of the good things that you can do. I think, I mean, the more green lungs there are out there, the more plants and leaves you're sowing or you're growing or, you know, cultivating, is the better. The more people you're inspiring to grow, you know, it's helping in some small way to reverse some of the awful stuff flying around the atmosphere right now. So there's that, but I think it's just all about growing sustainably, really. That's the big one for me. I think it's about right plant, right place. Make, you know, get plants in the ground that are happy in the ground. You don't want to be growing stuff that's that requires, you know, maximum input, that requires pesticides or fertilizers or excessive amounts of water. And that's whether you're doing it for cut flowers, you know, or you're doing it just for the garden. I think my big thing really is just like, there's so much more we can learn about how to keep plants happy. And actually it's not that complicated in terms of, you know, it's more about our learning about what plants to plant and where to put them, because, you know, we're covered in greenery. The world is covered in greenery and it wants to grow. And we just need to educate ourselves, I suppose, as to, you know, and find value in the kind of plants that like to grow into.
It does. And I just want to keep talking about that for a minute, because I haven't heard anybody talk about it from that perspective before. And it takes about like 8 times of repeating something to remember new information. And this is really important, because that connection between, like you were saying, you know, you really, really want to grow that dahlia, or you really, you know, want to grow a rose or whatever it is, but it's just not the right plant for this place. And to be able to grow it, we have to do tons of input, and we could use and redirect that energy towards something else and make a bigger impact that way. We're so used to seeing like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to grow, or this is what's trending and growing. But we can really just lean into our own environments and where we are, and pick up in that space. Talk more about it. So what are some good resources for that? How can we learn more?
Yeah, good question. I suppose it's about, I guess there's, what's really interesting to me is that like so many American gardens these days are being designed with these, with American plants, which is so good and it's amazing. And for a really long time, a lot of those, I mean, the biggest sort of designer on that front that's not a good way to say it, but Pete Udolph, who has designed these big gardens in America, is, you know, he's been championing American plants for a really long time. And I was chatting with one of the head gardeners, I think it was at the Lurie Garden, and just about the idea that that it took kind of a European designer in a way to start sort of using these unbelievably beautiful American plants in these American gardens for I suppose, and I might be wrong about this, but for Americans to start really sort of getting behind their own native flora and you know, and probably just as any country would, you know, some of the plants that they might consider weeds, to see them in that context. And I would totally understand that, you know, if you've grown up, I mean, it's, you're blessed in America, if you've grown up around amazing asters and goldenrods and all that kind of stuff, sure, you might consider them weeds, but to see them in the context of these beautiful gardens is happening more and more. And I think it's applying that to gardening all over the world. You know, it's trying to embrace our own weeds, our own plants that grow naturally in our environments, and see those. I mean, this works for the cut flower industry as well, you know, seeing them as amazing plants that you can put in flower arrangements, you know. And I love going and getting a few things from the local hedgerows and stuff, if I'm just doing a little display just for the house or for the garden museum or something, you know. I love getting wild carrot or cow parsley. These are, you know, wildflowers we have here. And So, but it's that idea. It's kind of embracing stuff that grows locally. So in terms of information for that, this is a long-winded answer, but I guess you circle back to your own sort of native floral guides, you know, to the books, to the sort of native floral websites and things. And I guess it's really just about learning what's on your doorstep and how you can use it.
So good. Oh, what a great conversation. So good to have you here. Thanks for joining us today, Matt. And everybody, don't forget to head over and pick up Matt's book called Forest.
Awesome. Yeah, really nice to chat with you. Thank you.
All of you professional florists that listen to the podcast, I just wanted to cheer you on. You guys have been working so hard in this post-COVID wedding world, especially those of you who really focused on weddings. I just have been seeing your events coming through on the feeds, these double, triple, quadruple header weekends, just with the backup of all of the jobs that were canceled and postponed and everything else. You guys are truly champions, and I imagine that you are really tired. And I just wanted to encourage you that we are going to be meeting together as a group in Albany after Mother's Day next year. We're going to raise a glass and cheers to the year that has gone by, and just really draw on the energy of being together. You know, people come into that event tired and they leave inspired and full of life. And I think that's something that we're all going to need next year. So I just wanted to plant the seed, let you know that it's happening. We are going to do it again. And as much as I love meeting with you digitally all of the time, and it's super fun, there is something that is so special about gathering in person. So keep it in mind. And whenever we have more details, we will keep you in the know. Okay. Good job. Go team.
Hello, my name is Marie Zudon, and I'm from Lutaflor. I'm a farmer florist in Canada in a 5B zone, growing zone. And what I'd like to talk to you about today is give you a few tips for creating your floral studio from scratch. Now, whether you're a flower grower, a florist or workshop leader, designing a floral workspace can be a really creative process that will inspire you each time you enter it. However, designing your workplace can seem daunting too. As you stand, as I did, in front of my space, a huge garage that was filled with extra supplies, empty boxes, and just in case building materials, you know the kind I mean, that just seem to accumulate and have a life of their own and basically take over the whole space. So I thought I would suggest here and offer some useful tips to help you navigate through this whole process, this whole transformative process. So the first thing I would emphasize would be to determine a really clear purpose for your space. Okay, so it's a floral space, but what's going to be done in it? What kind of projects will the space be used for? Floral production for large events, or maybe for do-it-yourself groups, or maybe some photo shoot, fashion photo shoots, community group meeting place, gift shop. These are all the considerations to help you clarify that vision that you have. Other consideration would be, okay, so how many people will it comfortably accommodate? And especially during these COVID times where we needed to have some social distancing, but also regularly, like, am I going to have other people coming into this space, or is it just going to be personal space for me, for my own use only? Other consideration, do you want to use your space year round or only seasonally? Being in Canada, that's northern US, we'll be able to relate. There's definitely considerations there in terms of insulation. Now, to help you establish that clear purpose for your space, maybe you need to create or want to create a vision board using like a large Bristol board and cutting out pieces of photos that you like, or maybe do an online Pinterest board just to help you focus your energies in a more visual fashion. Now, although it's highly recommended that you have a clear vision of the space that you want before you get started. Just remember to give yourself permission to allow this vision to evolve over time as you transform the space, as you maybe encounter limitations, or maybe you just redefine your business goals. So, second thing to do is hopefully you have a convenient location on your property or close by, and for ease of accessibility. But you really need to do your homework as to the municipal regulations regarding a commercial space that may involve some traffic flow. I know that in our area, we are allowed a home-based business, but there's kind of a limit on the amount of traffic flow that may result from it. So maybe finding parking areas close by or spreading out where workshop participants park, giving them clear instructions, you know, all of these considerations need to be kept in mind. Next is establish a budget for supplies and professional help. You know, it, like all renovations, it's so easy to let the budget get out of hand, but some clever planning of the transformation over time can help ease the financial burden. I gathered supplies during sales, and I used secondhand furniture, hand-me-downs from family and friends, and I did, you know, elaborate and spread the different steps over the renovations over the years. First year was just like trying to empty the space, paint it, refinish the cement floor, and start on the electricity. The second year, for example, I finished the electricity, then built some shelving units that were fixed and had some shelving units that were on rollers. And then maybe you go on to upgrade different materials and different furnishings that you add. Next, I would say that once you've established a budget for the supplies and the professional help, and you've kind of have a mapped out plan of when everything's going to happen, maybe it would be good to establish the steps so that, you know, you can tackle each one accordingly to your energy and your time availability, and of really avoid feeling overwhelmed by the whole process. So first you empty the space so that you can better visualize your end result. Now here you really need to be ruthless. And honestly, if you can't be, elicit the help of a trusted friend, which is exactly what I did on two occasions when I thought, I just cannot decide anymore whether I need this or don't need it. And I had a friend that really helped me out that way. When you clean the space, you've emptied it, but you clean it. And that way it allows you to evaluate any repairs or upgrades that are required. So remove stained or broken wall coverings or insulation. Pressure wash all that you can, refinish or redo the flooring to ensure it's like a comfortable surface, or at least one that is easily cleaned. And at the end of this clearing out process, you will see a space that went from clutter, which was totally my case, to endless possibilities, freshly painted walls, the nice surface, resurfaced cement flooring. Now, it's useful to share your vision with family, friends, and neighbors. You can rally some friends for help, but you can also use them to put out feelers as to what are the resources, what are the tradespeople that they know of, or maybe they have specific talents themselves that they're willing to share with you to help you realize your dream and vision. I was totally blown away by all the help that I did get from family and friends and even neighbors that really all pitched in and wanted me to succeed in this transformation. And another opportunity is to keep costs down. You remember that there's a possibility of a trade option. So for some of the services that I received, I offered a flower subscription for the people doing this work for me. And you would be amazed how that was so well received and appreciated. Now, the other consideration are structural considerations as you're going through this process. Now, don't be surprised if you need to bring some of the features or characteristics to your building or your space to code during your renovation, depending on how old the building is. Electricity is the first one that comes to mind because I had to redo the electrical work throughout the whole building. And from that stemmed the need to really visualize, okay, so what are the possible configurations of furniture, different functions, just to know where I need to have the outlets, where I need to have the proper lighting, and also to keep in mind, will the space be heated or subject to temperature and humidity fluctuations? That will have an impact on the covering and the casings of the electrical work that you get done. Another, other than electricity in terms of structural consideration, there's water source. Ideally, it would be great for you to have a water source within your floral space, but if not, there's also the great option of these outdoor stainless steel wash basins that can be hooked up to a hose, which is what I have. That way, workshop participants can wash their hands to their heart content, and using environmentally friendly soap, then the gray water that results from this outdoor stainless steel wash basin can be used to water the garden. So there's no waste there. Insulation is another structural consideration. So will you want to use your space year round? I've chosen in my area just to use it three seasons and forego the winter. Mind you, I miss it terribly in the winter. Now, the next step is space design for optimal flow and use. So whether it's a large space or a small one, you really want to maximize the use while retaining a flexible arrangement of furniture or add-ons. If you have that flexibility, then it'll allow you to adapt to your changing needs. Okay, so do you need that comfortable space for meeting a bride? Do you have sufficient surfaces, tables, chairs for flower arranging workshops? Can you clear the wall space for gardening courses that would be complete with a slideshow, which is what I've done? I've got one thing hanging on the one wall and it's easily removed, so that I can have slideshows. And then do you want to set up vignette areas for photo shoot opportunities, photo shoots of your own arrangements, of specific blooms that you have, or maybe your workshop participants who want to take a picture of their arrangements before they leave your space. You may want to think, do I want large event preparations? Do I do large events so that I need like some serious counter space for all of the centerpieces, etc.? Do I need to have a garden tool maintenance area for all the gardening related tasks? Or do I also want to have tuber and seed processing that we tend to do as a grower? So something that can be, the space can be converted to allow for all of these different functions throughout the season. Storage, shelving units, or other essential components necessary in your space. I found some great wire shelving units that are on wheels. So that way I can move them around. They can either be used to have the different flower selection for the workshops placed on it, or it could be another display area of different products that I offer. White walls offer a great backdrop to flower arrangements, but having said this, you may want a portion of a wall with a different shade, a different color. And if that's not the case, well, remember that backdrops of various colors for photography are always very easily accessible using secondhand drapes or tablecloths or sheets. They make very inexpensive options and provide you the flexibility that you need without having that permanent color on the wall. I would suggest once you have emptied, cleaned out, renovated, dealt with all the structural consideration, made out a design for what you consider an optimal flow of the space, to test it. Invite your friends and neighbors. And that will help you test the design, the space design that you've created. It'll help you fine tune the flow if you need any corrections to it. And they will be so happy to be part of that process and provide feedback on your design of your space. And there's a side benefit to inviting neighbors and friends to your space too, is that they will get on board and see exactly what's going on in that big garage, that big workshop. What is this woman doing? So it kind of breaks that little mystery and doubt of what's going on, but it also starts the word of mouth recommendations. And this is definitely what I have found in my neighborhood. Now, I'd like to just remind you to really creating an optimal space for your floral creativity is an evolving process. So I want to remind you that it's an evolving process. Your goals and interests may change over time as you use your space. So it's okay to adapt to your changing needs and redefine. And maybe you decide you don't want to have large events or other functions to your business model. But either way, that space will have been renovated and to your liking. Now, once you have the space and you've reevaluated your needs, you're fulfilling the mandate that you've given, that your business model asks of this space, there may be some consideration that you want to think about other sources of income for your space, on how else, what other income streams may materialize once your space is available. And here I'm thinking about community groups that may want to rent it out, use it, network events, writing workshops, photography courses. I've had fashion photo shoot sessions in my space. Book club meetings also has been a favorite for the space. So remember that the possibilities really are endless here. Now, after all is said and done, how will you know if you have succeeded in creating a wonderful space? Well, I'll tell you from my personal experience, you will likely have a perma smile as you enter your space, and your guests will feel inspired, energized, and sometimes will be reluctant to leave the workshop. So just, I hope these tips are useful for you in the process, but really enjoy the process, as I'm sure you will be enjoying the space for many years. So thank you very much for listening, and all the best.
Thanks for listening. You can find us over at teamflower.org for more resources like this one. And while you're there, check out the Team Flower Conference. That's where we all gather to learn and grow together. It is magic. You are magic. The work that you do with flowers matters. And we are so grateful for you. Keep going. You're doing a good job.